I assure you that I have not come to the point in my life where I subscribe to a local newspaper back home where I grew up just so I can read the obituaries every day. I understand that's what some people do. I go online. I get to read them without paying for them. And I do that because a lot of those people that I read about in that hometown newspaper are folks that I knew as a boy, people that I knew as far as their parents were concerned, or maybe their grandparents. But I have come to realize that there are a whole lot of people whose obituaries appear in my hometown newspaper that I don't know at all. The names of the families are totally unfamiliar to me. They're not people who were indigenous to that part of the country. They're not really connected to anybody who's been there for a long, long time. And yet, it is interesting reading sometimes just to do that. I want to begin this lesson this evening sharing with you what I consider to be an imaginary obituary that is predicated upon information that we get from the 23rd chapter of the book of Genesis. And so we're going to be talking this evening about how faithful people face loss. It's not a lesson that we usually talk about. It's not something that many of you maybe have ever even considered from a biblical standpoint. But I do believe that Genesis chapter 23 is going to reveal some important things to faithful people about what happens when we have to say goodbye to people that we love dearly. If you look here with me at this imaginary obituary that I composed, Sarah, the wife of the patriarch Abraham, died in her home in Hebron this past week of undisclosed causes. She was 127. She is survived by her husband Abraham, a son Isaac, and a stepson Ishmael. The longtime Canaan resident moved to our region from Mesopotamia, the home of her relatives, at the age of 65. She is best known in Canaanite society for her steadfast claims of a promise given to her husband by his God that her numberless descendants would someday own the entire land of Canaan. Often the object of ridicule and scorn due to her childlessness well into old age, Mrs. Abraham nevertheless surprised everyone with the announcement of the birth of a baby boy at age 90. She is the oldest woman known to have given birth since the great flood. Her husband is best known to residents of Canaan as the powerful prince who delivered the land from the scourge of the Chedorlaomer invasions. His reputation of honesty in life and business is well known across the region. Funeral arrangements are being handled by the family. Interment will be at Machpelah in the field of Ephron the Hittite, facing Mamre, and the time of the services are to be announced. There was no Hebron Gazette in those days, and so this obituary did not appear there. But if she were to have died today, this is the sort of thing that would be written about her, right? We do it, we've done it, and we will continue to do it for those whom we love who leave this world. Now, although the lens of Scripture has most often focused on Abraham, in this part of Genesis that we have been studying, I find it remarkable that the Holy Spirit saw fit to dedicate the entire chapter, 23, to the death of Sarah and to the burial of Sarah. And I think there's good reason for that. I'm going to be talking with us tonight about these verses, and in them we're going to talk about her dying, and we're going to talk about Abraham's mourning, and we're going to talk about her burial, because all three of those things are instructive for us. The announcement of Sarah's death comes rather suddenly, it seems to me, to the pages of the Genesis record, because the closing verses of chapter 22 described Abraham fresh off the slopes of Mount Moriah with his son Isaac after that boy was spared, that awful human sacrifice that God had proposed as a test for Abraham. And we studied about that last Sunday night. Verse 19 of Genesis 22 says this, that they arose and they went together to Beersheba, and Abraham lived at Beersheba. And those words in verse 19 represent the next 25 years in the life of Abraham, Sarah, and Isaac. And I think it is reasonable to believe that they were busy years. They were apparently uneventful years as far as a record for the Scriptures are concerned. Those were years, no doubt, that were filled with everyday matters of the nomadic life of Abraham and Sarah and Isaac and others that were associated with them. And so there would be the coming and going of the seasons in those 25 years. There would be the constant moving of the flocks and the herds so that they could get fresh pasture and water for them. There would be the lambing times, and there would be the shearing times, along with the births and the deaths of all sorts of people who worked for Abraham in those 25 years. Isaac would have by this time, of course, grown well into manhood. Most likely, he had been doted on much of his life by Sarah, as much as any mother ever could. Abraham had all these years been caught up in the responsibilities of his livelihood. One day he might look up into the distance and gaze out there and think about the promises that God had made to him, that one day all of this land that's surrounding him would be given to his descendants. He might even be wondering about the whereabouts and the doings of his son Ishmael, who is no longer living among them. Ishmael has moved to what is called the East. And it would not have been possible in those days for them to keep up with one another by text or by email or by phone call or even by a letter that someone would drop into the U.S. Postal Service and have it delivered a week later. There is, by the way, no indication that Ishmael ever returned to the tents of his father until after Abraham dies. And we will read that in Genesis 25 and verse 9, that Ishmael and Isaac will come together in order to pay their last respects to their father. God had made a prediction about Ishmael in Genesis 16. And that prediction in verse 12 was that his hand would be against everyone, and everyone's hand would be against him. And because of the nature of Ishmael's life, that probably precluded family visits back to Hebron where Abram would have been, because Ishmael was not a popular guy. Of course, during this time, Abraham and Sarah were up there in years. In fact, they were up there in years before Isaac was born. But they had just gotten older and older as time had gone on. And yet, Abraham is still a very vigorous man, even in his old age. He's going to take another wife after Sarah dies. And she dies at 127. He is 10 years older than her. And so he's 137 when Sarah passes away. And I am sure that those years are taking their toll on them, if not in their vigor, certainly in the fact that they have to outlive their loved ones. I think one of the difficulties of longevity has to be outliving the rest of the people in your generation. I hear that from a lot of 90-year-old people. Some 80-year-old people, but especially 90-year-old people plus, who tell you that there's nobody they grew up with who's living anymore. There's nobody that they were friends with in their 40s who's still around. Nobody that they raised their kids up together and they all played ball together and lived down the street from one another who's still able to visit with them. And everybody doesn't know about the things you know. The world they live in is very different than the world that you lived in when you were a 40-year-old person. And so I want you to see this, because in losing Sarah, Abraham was losing the last human being within his clan who would even remember what it was like to live in Mesopotamia, where they had come from years previously. And so when she died, he said goodbye to the last human being who would have been able to understand his struggles as he wrestled with the will of God in coming into Canaan. But we're getting a little ahead of the story here because in our text, I need to talk with you about her dying first. Look at verse 1 of Genesis 23. Sarah lived 127 years. These were the years of the life of Sarah. And Sarah died in Kiriath Arba, that is Hebron, in the land of Canaan. And Abraham went in to mourn for Sarah and to weep for her. There's a lot we'd like to know, I guess, about the death of Sarah, but there are not many words given to describe her death. The brevity of that account leaves a lot of questions that we humans have, like, how come she died? What was the cause of her death? Isn't that always what's asked when you hear from somebody about someone having passed away? Well, what did they die from? What caused their death? Did she fall suddenly ill, or had she been sick for a long time before she actually passed? Was there any warning, as is sometimes the case with older people? Or did she just fall asleep one night and never awaken? Was it a painful death? Did she have to suffer for a long time before she passed? Was her son Isaac there with her when she passed, maybe giving her a little laughter in those final hours? Was Abraham by her bedside? See, those things we don't know. Those are questions we'd like to know the answer to because we're humans and they were humans. But that none of these questions is answered might give us the mistaken idea that Sarah's life was not all that important to the scheme of Scripture. I don't think that's the case. Nothing could be further from the truth. Sarah is the only woman in the Bible whose age is recorded at her death. That's a sign of great importance among the early Hebrews. Listen to the records in Genesis, and they always want you to know how old a person was when they passed from this life. The prophet Isaiah would years later declare Abraham and Sarah as the mother and the father of the Hebrew people. Isaiah 51 in verse 2. And the apostle Peter would speak of Sarah as an example of the holy women of old who trusted in God and who possessed a inward spiritual beauty. We have even some reason to believe that Sarah was physically beautiful in her younger years. And by younger, I mean at 65. She was still very attractive, so much so that Abram feared that people would take her away from him. Sometimes the only way to account for the Bible's brevity in its descriptions is to recognize that the true intention is not to highlight the lives of its support characters as much as it is to describe the origins and the life of the one who is to come, that is Jesus. And so Jesus instructed those of His generation that the Scriptures spoke primarily about Him. John 5:39, Luke 24:37. So the death that we find described here was not that of an insignificant woman at all. She is not a woman of little account. Rather, it was the death of one of God's greatest servants, a woman who lived the life of faith, who should be remembered for her contribution, in fact, to all of our lives, because she was an ancestor of Jesus Christ. Now, if the description of her death was brief, so is the description really of Abraham's grief. If you look at verse 2, it just simply tells us that Abraham went in to mourn for Sarah and to weep for her. And did you know this is the only verse in the book of Genesis that describes Abraham crying? I've wondered if he shed any tears on Mount Moriah, but it's not recorded if he did. And I will tell you that it says here that he wept for her. He wept for her. He mourned for her. If there was weeping when he left his relatives in Mesopotamia years and years earlier, it's not recorded. If there was weeping when he interceded for Lot down there in Sodom, the Bible is silent about it. If he wept the day that Ishmael had to leave home and go off to points unknown, there's not one word about him shedding a tear then, but he cries in Genesis chapter 23 at the death of his wife. You know, grief is kind of like that. Surprises you sometimes how somebody's passing affects you. Someone that you didn't think would be all that meaningful to you if you lost them. Grief comes sometimes like a flood. suddenly, torrently, but you didn't really realize that it was going to affect you that way. Let me read you a description about grief that was written by a fellow by the name of Edgar Jackson, and I will tell you that he describes grief in very human terms. He said, grief is a young widow trying to raise her three children alone. Grief is a man so filled with shocked uncertainty and confusion that he just strikes out at everybody around him. Grief is a mother walking daily to a nearby cemetery to stand quietly and alone a few minutes before going about the tasks of her day. She knows that a part of her is in that cemetery, just as a part of her is in her daily work. Grief is a silent, knife-like terror and sadness that comes 100 times a day when you start to speak to someone who's no longer there. Grief is the emptiness that comes when you eat alone after eating with somebody else for many years. Grief is teaching yourself to go to bed without saying good night to the person who has died. Grief is the helpless wishing that things were different when you know they are not and never will be again. Grief is a whole cluster of adjustments, apprehensions, and uncertainties that strike life in its forward progress and make it difficult to redirect the energies of life. Now, I read all of that to you, and I want to say just as quickly as I've read that I cannot speak totally about what this man is writing with any first-hand experience. I understand that there is a loneliness quite unlike any other loneliness when someone loses their life's partner in death, because I've seen that. And you've seen that over and over and over again. And I say this with all the trepidation of the knowledge that either Beth or I are probably going to be in this situation one of these days with the other one. And I also want to say this out of deep respect for those of you who already have experienced this and who are in the midst of it even as I speak tonight. I readily admit my human fear about the loneliness I think I would feel at a time like that, because some of you have told me that that's what it's going to be like. And I also want to say that I fully expect that my faith in God is what will get me through it. Now, I may falter, and in fact, I may fail, but I know that my God will not fail, and I know that my God will not fail me, and I'm going to have to trust in Him like I've never trusted in Him when that day comes for me, if it does. And I hope, too, that whether or not such comes upon you, that we're both sensitive and sympathetic to everyone around us who has suffered the loss of a loved one. It's no small thing. The Bible doesn't condemn grief, by the way. When people sorrow the loss of someone that they love, the Bible doesn't say, oh, just get over it. The Bible doesn't say, oh, you're just so weak. Nowhere in the Scriptures does it tell somebody that you ought to rebuke somebody because they're still sad after a year or two or five or ten, that they've lost somebody that they love. And there is not one word of rebuke here to Abraham about the grief and the mourning that accompanies the loss of his Sarah. The Bible does speak about a grief that's experienced by the world. And Paul said in 1 Thessalonians chapter 4 and verse 13 that we don't want you to be uninformed, brethren, about those that have fallen asleep, that we do not grieve as do the rest. We grieve, but we don't have to grieve like those who have no hope. When we have mates who have committed their souls to Jesus Christ, that will be our comfort in that hour, where people who do not have that comfort, I don't know what they do. I don't know how they deal with that. There is a difference in the grief of a Christian and that of a person in the world, because our grief is that those who, while we're momentarily bereft of these loved ones, we look forward with hope to a hope that no unbeliever anywhere has. So we need to be sensitive to people that are grieving. Somebody may say, you know, Mark, I've never known what to do when somebody is grieving. Well, join the club. Join the club. Many of us find ourselves wordless when we can talk a blue streak otherwise. We don't know what to say. We don't know what to do. What am I supposed to say? What am I supposed to do? And many people, not knowing what to say or what to do, here's the wrong thing to do. Stay away. It bugs me a little bit that there are so many Christians, even in churches, who sometimes do not rally to the support of people that have lost someone simply because it makes them uncomfortable because they don't know what to say and they don't know what to do. Such a non-approach to the problem doesn't do anyone any good. I read a story from a fellow by the name of Leo Buscaglia a number of years ago about a contest that he had been asked to judge. He was an author and a lecturer, a well-known person in this community. And the purpose of that contest was to find the most caring child in that neighborhood. And the winner turned out to be a 4-year-old little boy whose next door neighbor was an elderly man who had just recently lost his wife. And upon seeing his elderly neighbor cry, the little boy went into the old gentleman's yard and climbed up into his lap and just sat there. And when the little boy's mother asked him what he had said to the neighbor, he said, "Nothing. I just cried with him." And I'm telling you, it's not more complicated than that. You don't have to say anything. But your tears will be helpful to somebody who's shedding a few of their own. So let's move now to what Abram has to do with Sarah's burial. Verse 3, as you read beginning there through verse 20, which is where this is encompassed, you'd think that the burial of Sarah would be the easiest and therefore the least mentioned part of Abraham's loss. But the burial is a hard thing. It's a difficult thing. It's a gut-wrenching thing. It's a final thing. Yet while Sarah's death is described in a verse and a half, and Abraham's grief is described in a half verse, the burial arrangements take up 17 verses. And I'll ask myself, why was this so complicated? Why so much information about what Sarah's burial entailed, about what Abram had to do to find a place for the disposition of her body? We have to remember that Abraham lived as an alien in a land that didn't belong to him, even though God had promised it to his descendants. And it's somewhat ironic, isn't it, that though Abraham had been in the land of Canaan now for over 60 years at this point, this land had been promised again and again and again to him and to his descendants, but he still didn't own a square inch of any of it. Not even a place to bury his dead. We need to remember that the next time the road of faith seems like it's becoming too long, that Abraham had a rough go, it seems to me, in the land of Canaan. The Hebrew writer tells us that Abraham would go all the way to the end of his life without seeing the fulfillment of God's promises to give him that land. And after describing the faith of quite a list of people, including Abraham, the writer of Hebrews says this: all these died in faith without receiving the promises. Hebrews 11, verse 32. So here is Abraham with no possession of any land in which to even dig a grave. And so he has to do something about it. Look at verse 3. Abraham rose from before his dead. He spoke to the sons of Heth and he said, "I am a stranger and a sojourner among..." He's lived here 60 years. And what does he say about his experience? He said, "I am," not "I was," "I am a stranger and a sojourner among you. Give me a burial site among you that I may bury my dead out of my sight." He's making his appeal to a family that's been in that land for generation upon generation. It's their land. They're not all that interested in it being anybody else's land. Look at verse 5. The sons of Heth answered Abraham and they said to him, "Hear us, my Lord. You are a mighty prince among us. Bury your dead in the choicest of our graves. None of us will refuse you his grave for burying your dead." So Abraham rose and bowed to the people of the land, the sons of Heth. And he spoke with them and said, "If it is your wish for me to bury my dead out of my sight, hear me and approach Ephron the son of Zohar for me, that he may give me the cave of Machpelah, which he owns, which is at the end of his field. For the full price, let him give it to me in your presence for a burial site." Abraham knew where he wanted to bury Sarah. He already had the place picked out in his mind, and it belonged to this Hittite named Ephron. But since the land didn't belong to him, it would have to be purchased. Look at verse 10. Now Ephron was sitting among the sons of Heth, and Ephron the Hittite answered Abraham in the hearing of the sons of Heth, even of all who went in at the gate of his city, and said, "No, my Lord, hear me. I give you this field, and I give you the cave that is in it. In the presence of the sons of my people, I give it to you. Bury your dead." I'm told by those that have studied the trading customs of the Hittites that while this sounds like a very generous offer, that he's just going to give Abram this part of land, it was really kind of a polite gesture that was part of their dickering back and forth. And that you really shouldn't take what he said at first all that seriously. Look at verse 12. Abraham bowed before the people of the land. He spoke to Ephron in the hearing of the people of the land and he said, "If you will only please listen to me, I will give the price of the field. You accept it from me that I may bury my dead there," making a purchase in the presence of the people at the gate where the elders of the city met was to them the same thing as you and me going to a closing at a title company and having documents that would be filed at the county courthouse and everybody would know that there'd been a transfer of ownership from one person to the other. Read verse 14. Then Ephron answered Abraham and said to him, "My Lord, listen to me. A piece of land worth 400 shekels of silver, what is that between you and me? So bury your dead." He's just letting him know that this is a back and forth process. It's not any big deal. It's not all that much money. And he brings up the asking price. He has a, like Abraham knew where he wanted to bury Sarah, this guy knows what this property's worth. He already knows that it has a value. And he has told Abraham what the value of this would be. And that indicates to me that this is a back and forth dickering process that was just customary among people that were trying to strike a deal. So verse 16 says that Abraham listened to Ephron. And Abraham weighed out for Ephron the silver, which he had named in the hearing of the sons of Heth, 400 shekels of silver, commercial standard, the New American Standard Bible says. So the purchase was made. Now let's read the last verses. So Ephron's field, which was in Machpelah, which faced Mamre, the field and the cave which was in it, and all the trees which were in the field that were within all the confines of its border were deeded over, verse 18, to Abraham for a possession in the presence of the sons of Heth before all who went in at the gate of his city. And after this, Abraham buried Sarah, his wife, in the cave of the field at Machpelah facing Mamre, that is Hebron, in the land of Canaan. So the field and the cave that is in it were deeded over to Abraham for a burial site by the sons of Heth. Now, why would the Holy Spirit spend so little time on Sarah dying and Abraham grieving, but so much time on the burial arrangements? Does that strike you as a little odd? What's the significance of that? Well, let me suggest this answer. I believe that the decision to bury Sarah in Canaan was another big step of faith for Abraham. It seems to me that it's nearly universal for people to want their dead buried in their homeland. Right? among their own people, among their relatives when they die. They don't want their loved ones buried in some foreign territory. You know, during the great foreign wars of our country, the Second World War and the Korean conflict and Vietnam and the Gulf War and the Iraq and the Afghanistan conflicts, it's always been that we do everything we can to return the remains of our servicemen killed in action to the shores of this country. Right? We don't want them buried off someplace else. We want them to be brought home. And we don't abandon their remains to a strange place or to strange people. And we make those efforts because the idea of dying and being buried a long way from home among strangers, well, that just brings a certain dread to all of us. And so for Abraham, the desire to take Sarah back home would have been no less compelling for him. In this context, home could still mean Haran, where his father had died and where he was buried. Genesis 11:32. It could even mean that she would be carried back to Ur, where his brother Haran was laid to rest and where they've probably still got generations of relatives that have been living. Abraham surely realized that he would one day be laid beside Sarah wherever that grave might be. And so the desire to be among his kin must have been a part of his consideration of her final arrangements. And yes, I know that he had been in Canaan for 60 years now. But by his own admission, the sons of Heth in verse 4 were told that I am still just a stranger here. I am still just a sojourner among you. He didn't own a square inch of that country in which 6 decades had been taken up in his life. And the only thing he could leave behind to his children in Canaan as an inheritance was this promise that God had made that someday this land would belong to their descendants. Now with Sarah dead and the need to settle her burial place pressing upon him every hour, where is he going to lay her to rest? Is he going to lay her to rest in this land where he was still a stranger and an alien? Or is he going to take her to the homeland of his relatives? You see, I think that's the reason so much time, so much paper and ink is given to this particular discussion. And God is commending through this Abraham for the choice that he made because Abraham chooses not to return to Mesopotamia to bury his dead. He is not going to ultimately be buried in Mesopotamia himself because God has promised him that this ground is where his descendants are going to be. The people that come after him, the nation that proceeds from him, that's going to bless all nations, it's going to occupy this place in Canaan. And so Sarah's tomb and ultimately the tomb of Abraham himself would forevermore tie their descendants to this promised land. And Abraham saw that. He understood that God's promise was important. And he would continue his stand in Canaan right up until the very end. Maybe you've seen this and maybe you haven't, but this is Sarah's burial place. Now, it didn't look like that when Abraham buried her there. But this is Machpelah, that cave. And let me tell you, it's not just that she was buried there. Ultimately, when he laid down in death himself, he was buried here. And then ultimately, later on, Isaac and Ishmael and Isaac and Rebekah will be buried here. And Jacob buries Leah here. And one day Joseph returns to Machpelah to bury Jacob there. And Joseph, upon his death, was embalmed and placed in a coffin in Egypt. And when the Israelites left Egyptian bondage, they carried out with them, Genesis 50 and verse 25, the body of Joseph. And so we assume that he too would have been placed in this cave that all of these patriarchs of this great nation would have been buried in. Do you understand now why family cemeteries are such a thing? In our culture even? and why we like to know where people are going to be buried, and we want to keep up with where they may be, and we want to be buried near our relatives. Those are the reasons decisions are made like that. I want to leave you tonight with just a couple of quick lessons that speak to us from this chapter. And one of them simply is this. It's okay to grieve when we lose somebody that we love. And for those of us who are Christians, it's bittersweet because we know that we're going to see them again. We know that. We just don't know how long it'll be. But we're going to see them again one day, and they're not going to be sick anymore, and they're not going to be pained anymore, and they're not going to be tempted anymore, and they're not going to be in a place where we have the same worries together that we had while we were living here on earth. The washing machine's not going to break. The sprinkler system isn't going to be dug up in the yard. The dog isn't going to die. The children aren't going to move away. All those things that we've struggled together with about from day to day in this life will be no more, but we'll get to be where they are. Because they will be with us and we will all be with the Lord. The Bible treats grieving as a natural part of life, and we don't need to be ashamed of grief. And conversely, the rest of us need to be doing everything we can to support and to comfort those who grieve. Here's the second thing this whole story tells me. Decisions that we make when someone dies can have an effect on the future. If Abraham had taken Sarah's body back to Haran, why, we might be reading an entirely different story here in the Bible. Death and the way we deal with it can be an opportunity to forward the cause of God. Here's another thing. It's important for people of faith to make right decisions all the way through their lives. We don't live lives of faith in our youth and then go into spiritual retirement in old age, so that we don't have to be worried about such things anymore. The great saints of old served God in their decisions right up to the last breath they drew. And we should do no less. There is no such thing as retiring from spirituality. In many ways, we as Christians are like Abraham, because we, as Peter puts it in 1 Peter 2 and verse 11, are strangers and aliens in this land. We may have been here all these years, but we don't belong here. Our citizenship, Philippians 3 and verse 20 says, is in heaven, and we look forward to the fulfillment of a promise of being able to go to heaven that will be given to us, because Jesus says, I've gone to prepare that place for you. And in my Father's house, He said, there are many, a multitude of dwelling places. We forego the heavy investment in the things of this world that all of our neighbors are making because we're preferring rather, as the Hebrew writer puts it in Hebrews 11 and verse 16, to be seeking a better country. That is a heavenly one. God is not ashamed to be called the God of people who are wanting to go to heaven, who are making all of their plans to live eternally with Him, because God, Hebrews 11, 16 says, has prepared a city for them. So let's not forget Abraham and his faithful wife, Sarah. Let's not forget the contribution that they make to all of us of like faith. They served God in their lives. And guess what? They continue serving God even in death. Because here these 2,000 plus years later, 4,000 plus years later, we're sitting here tonight studying about all of the things that people of faith do. And one of the things that people of faith do is that they deal with their losses in faith. And may we have the strength and the wisdom to be able to do it when that time becomes ours. You know, the greatest thing you can do for your loved ones is be a child of God, because I don't know how many times I've had to rely on that in trying to comfort people. Have you ever had to do that? The greatest blessing you can be to anybody that loves you is to obey God, so that when it comes your time to lay down and die, you don't have to be a grief of mind about what's going to happen to you next. That is a blessing, to not have to be concerned about that. And you can do that by appropriating the blood of Christ to your spirit. And if this evening you need to obey the gospel, do it. Do it because you need it, but do it because of the blessing it's going to be to the people that will come after you. Do it because it's the right thing to do. And because you can't go to heaven without it. And you surely don't want to be unprepared. And if you are a Christian and you need our prayers and our help and our concern, don't be afraid to say that. Don't be afraid to say, I'm hurting. I need some prayers. I need some help. Reach out to other people when you're grieving. They may not know what to say, but they want to help. You know they do because you've been in that situation too where you want to help, you just don't know what to do. And so just being there, being present, letting someone know you care, and doing that and that alone can make a lot of difference in the lives of people who are hurting. If we have a way this evening that we'd be of service to you, we encourage you to make a response. While together